You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Minutes after 8 here on the West Coast. So if you're fat and you're on the East Coast, 53 minutes before you get to eat lunch, so good for you. Joining me, I don't know if he's fat or not. He should be. He's a former Marine. And that means he's used to be in the Marine Corps, but he's not on active duty anymore, okay? So just so none of y'all get your panties in a knot, okay? That's what that means. Is Todd South. And first of all, Todd, thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
No problem. I can answer questions to the best of my reporting. I'm not going to even pretend to be an expert. A lot of folks know more about this than I do, but I'd be happy to contribute.
Okay. No, that's what we love. But we need to find out about you. You and I were talking a little bit before we came on the air. But okay, so Todd is a writer for Marine Corps Times. So you're a writer for Marine Corps Times. How does that work? Do you work for Military Times and your stuff appears in Marine Corps Times? Because I see different names on different times, and there's a bunch of them. So how does that whole work?
Yeah, I won't get too wonky, but we're definitely a modern media kind of animal now. For the longest time, people are very familiar with any service branch. There's the Army Times, Marine Corps Times, Air Force Times, and Navy Times, and that's a twice a month print publication. It's on every newsstand across the globe. Just about any base. That's been around in some form since Army Times in the 1930s, I believe. And then it ran that way up until a few years ago. The Gannett Company had owned it for a couple decades. They're the ones that publish USA Today. They sold it to a private investor who now owns those, along with Defense News, which is an industry publication, kind of writes about industry and government contracting.
Right.
So now we have a single senior writer per publication. And then we have folks like me. I'm technically, they call Purple because I write for all publications, but I'm only mostly focused my beat on ground combat.
Nice.
So I do a lot of Army and a lot of Marine. And there's a little grayer there. I'll dip in on some drone stuff or cyber stuff or help out, cover an event, but my main focus is the ground formations for the Marines and for the Army and the combat elements of those formations.
Okay, but you're Purple, which means your stuff can appear in any of them, yes?
Correct. Yeah. And so, for instance, I do stories occasionally. I'll help out, do a story on like a VA issue,
right,
or something that affects all services. Like I like to write stuff about DARPA. DARPA is kind of interesting, and most of what they do is going to hit all the services in some form or fashion. So yeah, Purple means, so if you think about it like in a flow chart or like an organizational chart, like Military Times is the big umbrella.
Yeah.
And then under that are all those publications I mentioned. So we kind of can share content between. And we have some folks out of this office, some folks work remotely in different parts of the country and overseas. Not a huge staff. We all kind of write for everything. It's a new age, quote unquote, of media, like very few people writing a lot of stuff for a lot of places.
That sucks. It used to be better when you were like one guy, one publication, a little bit easier, work meter, not so tyrannical. Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a good opportunity. You're right. I mean, I came out of the Marines in 2003 and went straight to journalism school and went straight to work for a publication. So I've been doing that about 12 years. And most of those 12 plus years I've been doing that, it was local newspapers. It's your good old school kind of, this paper covers this town and these four counties, and you have a cops reporter and a courts reporter and a city government reporter. I did that for all my career until I came here.
The way it should be, man. That's the way God drew it up when we talk about newspapers.
Well, hey, man, if people would pay for news, we could still do it, but everybody wants it for free,
So. You know what? So how long before we don't have print newspapers anymore? 5 years?
I mean, I'm no industry expert,
but
you know, I don't know. I think there's always going to be a place for a niche audience for print. I mean, I still, you know, I'm not that old. I'm not quite, I'm a year away from 40, so I'm not too old yet, but I still like reading on print.
Okay, hold on, exactly. Okay, first of all, is anybody 19 saying, oh yeah, he's not that old, he's only 40? No, he's like, yeah, this old dude, yeah, how old was he? He's 40. Yeah.
You're right. I definitely thought that when I was 19, that's for sure. But,
exactly,
yeah,
right?
In context.
Now you hear 50-year-old people saying, yeah, 50's the new 30. You don't hear anybody, you don't hear anybody 30 saying that. Yeah, like, yeah, this old dude, he was 50. So anyway, just for the record,
all perspective.
All right, keep going. But print. So, but you're getting more and more papers across the country saying, you know, and if you look at their plight, online content, at the same time, online classified ads, which destroyed one of the huge cash cows that newspapers had, which were their classified ads, because that's how we bought and sold stuff, and. Those double whammies are seeing newsrooms squeezed around, especially in rural America, squeezed out of existence. And it's pretty sad.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir. I worked; those were my first couple jobs, were rural areas in Georgia and Alabama, and then a mid-sized area in Tennessee. Like I definitely have an affinity for that for sure. Like I came up with that, but you do have to adapt. You know, you can't hold back the tide. You know, I'm not trying to sound too cliche, but it's just, if you want to keep doing this work, you got to adjust. You know, you can't, you know, if you want to go out on a sinking ship, I guess you can, but I'd like to stay afloat, so.
All right, talk to us about, so born and raised where?
speaking of rural, yeah, I was born and raised in West Kansas. For the Western folks out there, I was born and raised in Dodge City, Kansas, which is the whole wider Batman.
Yeah,
how about that? Yeah, so I grew up out there, grew up on a farm for part of my youth and left there pretty quickly, within a year of graduating high school from Marine Corps boot camp in San Diego.
What kind of farm?
Dairy farm.
Let me tell you, there's farms you want to grow up on and farms you don't want to grow up on. And I will tell you that growing up on a dairy farm, that's a hard-working farm. And that's up early, too, if they let you sleep.
Oh, yeah. No, you kind of grain you pretty quickly being an early riser. I still, to this day, I mean, my dad sold the farm when I started high school, so I didn't have to do a lot of the grunt labor, just basic chores. And, to this day, again, as my ancient, almost 40, but, you know, I still get up early just by nature, so.
There you go. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Oh, man, that's a funny story. I like when people ask that, because I don't know if it's traditional. So, I just, from the earliest I can remember, wanted to get out and see the world. And I really wanted a challenge. I was in like wrestling and football at a young age and martial arts and, just started reading all, you know, it was late 1980s, early 90s, reading a lot of like the books about Vietnam and the SEALs and recon Marines and all that stuff and seeing all the movies at the time, you know, people my age would remember those. They're a lot better now, I think. And I just, the military was a natural, like that's what I got to do to get going. And I literally went into a recruiting office, I was 13. And just said, how do I do this? This is like pre-internet. You know, how do I do this? I know I'm not old enough yet, but how do I get started? And, kind of flirted with doing the academies for a while because I was a pretty good student. My best buddy and I were kind of flirted with that because he had a cousin who had gone to the, Naval Academy. And, but then just, we thought, you know, because we were dumb, hardcore teenagers, like, oh no, we're going to be, you know, real Marines. We'll go enlisted first and then we'll be officers later, you know, if
yeah,
we want to.
Exactly.
So we both signed infantry. I was, slated for a 6-year infantry contract, right out of high school. I graduated early, like was leaving at 17 to go to boot camp. And, a week prior, I went on a recreational parachute jump and I shattered my right ankle.
Whoa.
So I was definitely not ready to go to boot camp. My buddy went on without me. He went on infantry, did his thing. We stayed in touch and I had to spend a year doing rehab. And so I went to community college, got some class credits, did all my rehab, kind of got healed up. And recruiter, I think, in the long run was looking out for me. On the short run, I didn't like what he had to tell me, but he kind of pushed me with good ASVAB scores over to the radio comms portion, like, hey, look, you'll still go to the field, you'll still get to go on the Muse and deploy, you'll still have a shot at going to recon, but let's not, like, overdo it. You know, get through boot camp, get through MCT, and see where your ankle's at, and you're good enough for MEPS. So I took his advice, did that, did a 5-year contract instead on radio communications, wound up becoming a technician because I had high scores, and did that initially, and then I did some other stuff later in my enlistment. So.
All right. That is kind of interesting. No, I will tell you, it's always one of the more interesting questions when you ask people how did they join the Marine Corps? And what's funny is almost like the playbook that I've begun to learn about. I swear a third of the guys get told, yeah, go away. There's probably one of the other services is better for you. And the reaction is, what? You don't want me? Like, nah, man, you're a little small, you're a little scrawny, I don't think you're like your Marine. And then they all laugh and say the hook was set then, I was going in the Marine Corps come hell or high water. And so it's always a funny question to ask. You come in the Marine Corps, and so you go to comm school. Tell us about your career. You spend 5 years. What do you do?
Yeah, so I still was, again, people think I'm an idiot, you know, but they gotta remember that the internet was not really a thing. It's like, there wasn't really a way to find out about this stuff unless you knew somebody, or unless you'd like read a book or something. And all the books that I had read were like Vietnam era stuff, right? So I really still thought, like, I believe what the recruiter said, you know, I believe what the drill instructor said. Like, I got sent over to 29 Palms after MCT to do comm school. I wind up in the tech school and just was like, oh my God, this is not what I expect. I was not planning on reading schematics and taking apart circuit cards. This is not the Marine Corps poster. What the hell, you know?
Right.
And I can't do anything about it. I'm at that point, I guess I was Lance Corporal maybe. And I got shipped over to Okinawa for my first duty station. I did request overseas. I got Okinawa, and wouldn't you know it, I got into a garrison non-deployable maintenance company.
Nice.
So I sat my butt on the rocks for a fucking year, excuse my language. While all my other buddies, the radio operators, you know, went out on the Muse or did stuff over in Thailand, or I was just grinding. Now I'm hitting, year two and a half or so after training, getting almost halfway through my contract, and I haven't done anything that I was told I was going to do. So I got back to the States to 8th Comm, also known as 8th Crime by a lot of folks at that time.
Why is this? Because 9th Comm is known as 9th Crime. Why is that? Why are the comm battalions, like, are they bored? Are they just smarter than everybody else, and they're bored, and so they look for?
I think they're smart enough to get in trouble, but not smart enough to not get caught. That's my two cents. I don't know.
That would be that is quintessentially Marine-like.
Yeah. So I wound up there, and this is old. We're going back. This is like year 2000, I think. It was 2000. So at that time, the 8th Communications was literally around the corner from the 2nd Recon Barracks in French Creek. And I had a buddy who was our ammo tech over there from high school. And again, it's super informal. There was nothing, no internet post. Literally, they would post on like a poster board, INGDOC tryouts for recon. I'm like, oh crap, I'll go do that. I can do that. I'll 300 PFT or I can handle it. So I went over and did it, kicked my butt just to keep up with everybody, but I made the cut. Did the INDOC. They cut me orders like 2 months later over there because they were hurting for communicators too. And I went straight into the in-house, at the time, the in-house recon school, which they called RIP or RTP. RIP was Recon Indoctrination Platoon. RTP was Recon Training Platoon. And so just an in-house school. This is pre 9/11, no budgets, no money, no schools. And so I did just like an in-house thing. It was like a 3-month course. And you learn to tie the knots. You do, all the finning. You do all the, PT yourself to death. You can do a bunch of ruck marches and ruck runs and all the different recon patrol packages, Kim's games, things like that, all on base. And literally like as we were finishing our kind of amphib phase on site before everybody was going to ship off to the actual then ARS up in, I think it was Little Creek, Virginia, because they also had BRC, basic reconnaissance course out in, Coronado. They had them split, now they've combined them. I tore my rotator cuff on my left shoulder. And by the time I rehabbed it out and was going to cycle back in, I had less than a year on contract. And they said, well, we're not going to send you to MOS school unless you reenlist. And I was just burnt out by now. I was like, I can't. Like, I've spent, 4.5 years of my life trying to do the actual Marine thing. And I basically got like 3 field training operations where I worked comms for teams. It just didn't compute,
Wow.
So I was shipped back up to the comm shop and headquarters company of the battalion. And I was going to just ride out my next 6 months, fixing comm gear and then EAS. And then we invaded Iraq, so that changed things.
That ankle, that'll teach you to go skydiving and do all that crazy shit, man. That's a heavy price. Yeah, yeah. 3 field ops in 4 years of the Marine Corps. You got to be kidding me. That's insane. Okay, so talk to us about, so you're with 2nd Recon during the March up. What was that like?
Yeah, it was interesting. People laugh now because, you know, we just come off Afghanistan. I can't remember who came from 2nd to go to the Afghan invasion. I didn't know those guys. I had a buddy on the Mew who went from my comm at MLS school. We'd food state buddies. He was part of that Mew that did the invasion in Afghanistan. And I think a lot of people at the time thought that was it. You know, I mean, Afghan's good. And then the march up to back to Iraq came. You know, it's like, oh, this is going to be really the mentality of a lot of people at that time was this is going to be another desert storm. You know, we're going to sit in the desert, like a Desert Shield kind of thing for like a year, and then we're going to invade, bomb the heck out of it. There's not going to be any ground combat, and it'll all be over. I mean, a lot of people had that mentality. People forget, you know, 15 years later. And so what they did at the time, they were so focused on the Mews. This is pre-MARSOC. So right. The force recon guys and the battalion recon guys were totally focused on Mew rotation. And so our kind of premier guys all schooled up and loaded up and experienced, you know, were pushed to that. Well, I was part of Alpha Company as kind of like on paper, even though I was in the comm shop in headquarters company, because they needed a communications tech and they also needed additional communicators, for the Alpha Company. And so we'd actually done a stint in Bridgeport and done the NATO exercise in Norway that winter, before. And so most of the guys that were still attached to that unit all had like cold weather training. None of us had been to, at the time it was called CACS, now it's called ITX out in Tornon Palms.
Right.
None of the guys, that as far as I knew had any like vehicle, like, you know, mounted, you know, patrolling training, you know, heavy weapons training beyond like SOI. And they literally kind of had us on a list. I got kind of pretty much tapped on the shoulder after I came off of New Year's leave and said, you got 4 days to go pack your shit, you know, write your will and get a Humvee license because you're going on the baton and you're shipping over to Kuwait. I'm like, okay. So instead of terminal leave, I got a Humvee license and packed my shit up and wrote a will and wrote some rent checks for my girlfriend who I was splitting a place downtown with for the next 4 months so I could cover my end of rent, and got on a ship, and we got over to Kuwait in, I guess, I don't know, like a couple weeks, and then we sat in Kuwait for a few months before the invasion, and I guess it was March 20th, I remember the dates. And then we did, like, I mean, a lot of people, if they know their history, like the first recon guys, they became the subject of that book, Generation Kill.
Right.
So there was an HBO miniseries, very, very well done, a good book, a good article, a really good miniseries. Like, a lot of the language and the tone I thought was really accurate. From I knew a couple of the guys from there.
A little bit secondhand. A little bit overstated, though, yes?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, but it's a dramatic thing.
Right. You
that's
do
story,
have to make
storytelling. Yeah,
you have to make
this
it.
This isn't an op-order or like an official history. People got to take from life.
Just,
you know, that's
just so everybody knows, it's a money-making event. So...
Yeah.
So when you see like the thermobaric hand grenade, they're not. Mm-hmm. It's more dust than it is like flash flame ball in a hand grenade. Just for, so everybody knows, we're talking about that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right. We're talking about
yeah,
that.
No, I mean in terms of kind of capturing a feeling, you know, and having right. since become a writer and done different types of reporting and projects and journalism, like I can totally see the difference, and I can definitely point out the flaws for sure. I mean, right. from that perspective, but definitely coming out of it, it captured more of the feeling that I had for parts of it. We didn't face a fraction of the contact that they did. You know, we were in the southern part with Task Force Tarawa, part of 2nd Med, kind of the support for the march up. While 1st Marine Division hit Baghdad, and while I think it was 3rd ID and the Army helped them hit Baghdad, and the Army was up north. You know. Near the Kurdish region, we were mostly kind of, we're supposed to just be mopping up stuff and like doing security for supply routes. The big thing that hit, I think it made a lot of news, was the Najriya
right.
incident where there's a friendly fire issue, there's a sniper alley, and the bridge was got blown up, and that Army PFC, the female PFC, and some others got captured.
Right.
We literally rolled up on that, like within, you know, a couple clicks of that, probably just a few hours after it happened. So we're just back in the line. And then our main job was to push out, find a route around the city to continue to flow north. And so we just continued the rest of the deployment next couple, 3 months, just securing routes up. You know, we'd secure a route, secure a bridge, find a crossing, you push out and do just basic route security. And then they would flow through, and then we would leapfrog ahead once we got relieved to push out again to do the next forward route. So, I mean, I think one of the squads, in our company, I wasn't a part of it. I was with the captain the whole time running the vehicle and running the comms. They did like a dismounted foot recon, daytime patrol, actually, if I remember right, near, I think it was near the Euphrates. And I believe they captured a guy there who had a weapon, and that was most of the, and we had a couple of pot shots here and there going through some towns, but no heavy, real heavy combat. So I can't lay any credit to being a combat veteran. I will never say that. So,
Give me a lesson learned from it. When you reflect on
let's learn from going from the Iraq deployment.
From the Iraq deployment. So if and I do have two sons, if you were gonna give my sons one piece of advice before going to war to prepare them, what would it be?
Oh man, that's a hard question. I have to write an essay about that probably. Just real practical advice. I would just like know your basic skills, know your place in the formation, and know the people around you, and communicate. I mean, that's super generic, but that's practical advice. I mean, I guess mentally, just there were a couple dicey times. I mean, we didn't have to do anything Hollywood style or nothing cool that anyone could make a movie about. But there are a couple dicey times we got shot at in sandstorms, and you had a real sense of like that metal taste in your mouth, like I'm gonna get shot and killed, and I can't even see who's shooting at me. And you just gotta be prepared for the fact that that might be it, man. Like just make sure you tell people you love them before you leave, because it could be it.
So. You know, it is an interesting question, and I'm gonna write a book that includes all the different response I've gotten, and it might be multi-volumed, but. What I'd like to do is invite people to write a chapter. If you were to tell one, and that's one of the interesting things about make sure you tell people that you love them, because this comes up on a regular basis. We talk about no matter what generation of Marines that you talk to, from what era, when you say goodbye, you don't know if you're coming back alive. How terrifying that is. Right, especially if you have kids and even if you don't have kids, I mean, it's terrifying to look around and say, I mean, I don't know if I'm ever going to come back here. I don't know what's in front of me. So, interesting advice. My guest is Todd. What rank did you get out of the Marine Corps at? Sergeant?
Sergeant. I made E5 Sergeant.
Sergeant, Todd South, formerly of the United States Marine Corps. He's now a writer for Marine Corps Times. The pistol buy that the Army has going, no small amount of controversy goes with it. $580 million. That's a lot of money. And for 20,000 pistols. You know, I did the math. If you cost it out at $180 a pistol, you can buy 3 million pistols. And so, you know, when you look at the money, and so you don't even need any spare parts. Just give them a new one. Hey, we've got 3 million of these things. We only need 200,000. Yeah, we got more than we can break. So here's a new one. We'll take those, and that's where our spare parts come from. I'll fix it next time. Talk to us about this pistol buy that the Marine Corps, the Air Force, and the Navy are all going to pile onto. So it has to do with the procurement system and all kinds of interesting things. The drop test that was in the news so much. Give us a general overview of this pistol buy by the Army.
I'm going to speak in as general terms as I can, because I have written about it. I have not written in detail about the procurement, so I can answer like big picture questions about that probably.
Right.
And my involvement with it kind of started when I started here about a year ago. So I've had about a year of it under my belt. I can all quickly defer to even to my competitors who've been covering this issue for a number of years, but just to give people kind of the broad context. So I don't have all the dates and figures in front of me, but a number of years ago, this actually started as an Air Force project, which is kind of, I don't know if you call it ironic or just coincidental, because that's the same way the M-16 started, was an Air Force project, to create a quote-unquote modular handgun. And modular meaning, like, you can mix and match pieces and parts. Like, you can have a handgun that's not one-size-fits-all, like, in terms of, you know, whether you got small hands or big hands, whether you like, you know, this kind of configuration or that, you just got to deal with it, which is the way, you know, most of the kind of service-wide firearms have always been. So that started a a number of years ago. I wish I had written this down or had it in front of me. And it kind of got pushed from the Air Force. The Army kind of took ownership of it because they were in the process of, like, reviewing replacing the handgun, which previously was the Beretta M9, which had been in service since, I believe, 85 or 86. And that had replaced the 1911 A1 and its variants, which is a 45 caliber pistol, actually built, I want to say, in the World War I time frame, and came into use in service for the next 70-odd years, I think, through World War II and the subsequent conflicts. So the idea with the modular handgun program was to create something that was, you know, chambered in an appropriate round for lethality and accuracy, but also modular so you could change grips. You could easily maintain it, take it apart very easily. It was very user-friendly in the shooting. A lot of problems that people have noted over decades with the M9, it has its lovers, it has its haters, you know.
Right.
But a lot of problems for that was the decocking lever, the safety issues,
right.
Single action, double action,
right.
Make people a little bit less accurate unless they were super familiar with it or done a lot of training on it. So the modular handgun was kind of aimed at fixing those, you know, pardon the pun, but also had to have, you know, advanced, you know, capabilities in terms of attaching suppressors, attaching lights, you know, either on the rail system or, you know, even a red dot scope on the top. None of those were capable with the M9 unless you made major modifications to them, which they had done. Actually, the Marine Corps, I believe, has like a version 3 of it still in its arsenal, which is a heavily modified M9. The problem is if you take any frame of a weapon and you start modifying it, you're trying to make it do something it wasn't built to do. So that was kind of the impetus of starting the modular handgun system program. And then there was kind of like a lot of the procurement programs, there was kind of an open call to industry. They didn't even make it caliber specific, so people could submit multiple types of caliber configurations, like 45 caliber, like the old 1911, 40
right.
caliber, which is like a nice midway point between a 9mm and a 45.
Right.
And of course, 9mm, which is standard for NATO. So, I mean, I'll pause there. I'm babbling.
Let me tell you, we talk about this all Marine Radio, man. We talk about this stuff. So, most everybody in the listening audience is pretty savvy to all the things you're saying, from the procurement system to the NATO requirement. To the modular aspect of it, because I don't know if you may or may not know him, but former First Marine Division gunner Mike Musselman is a good buddy of mine. We've deployed 3 times to Iraq and Afghanistan, and he comes on the program and we talk about these kind of issues, you know, so he's a gun guy, so we do gun talk, which is a big fan favorite. So anyway, no, we're with it, man. So don't be afraid.
Sure. Oh no, and on the same token, hey, I'm just to be frank with everybody listening, I'm sure there's probably like whoever's listening now or whoever listens later on the podcast, at least half of the guys and gals listening are going to be like, this guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. My gun knowledge, like I grew up hunting and shooting and doing different kinds of tactical shooting just for really like a salvage lot with buddies because we were trying to pretend to be Marines before we went off and actually got training. I read all the gun magazines growing up, but then I kind of got out of that world for a lot of reasons. I just didn't have the money to keep doing that. I had other life commitments. So my gun knowledge beyond the reporting I've done for this particular story and some other recent stuff this last year is like dated by about 15 plus years. So I'm definitely going to screw some stuff up. Your friend, the gunner, I mean, that's his whole life and career.
Right.
Anything I say that he counters, take what he says. Take what he says.
So far, you haven't countered anything he said. Well, you know, in just the background of the historical origin of the requirement and where it came from and all that. Now, that's all good information as you try to get your mind around, like, you know, what are we doing here, and is it going to be a good thing, or is it going to turn into those, you know, a souped up horse by committee turns out to be a camel, you know. So no, keep going. We're good with it. You're so far so good, man.
Yeah, so that laid out into, you know, the people actually submitting their bids. Not people, I'm sorry, the companies, of course. You know, of course, Beretta had their submission. Glock had its submission. You know, Glock's a big favorite among a lot of shooters and a lot of tactical units for many, many years. Bit of irony, or just kind of historical note. Again, a lot of the gun folks are going to know this, but folks not as familiar might not know. In the original test trials in 85, 86, SIG actually beat out Beretta on a number of, like, technical aspects on their submission at that time. I think that was the P226, but I may be wrong. If I'm wrong, I apologize. I'm fairly close. that was later adopted, I believe, by the SEALs, by some the SEAL Team 6, the dev group guys.
Right.
But the SIG option at that time was more costly than the M9. So in a weird kind of twist of fate, like SIG may have actually gotten that contract back in 85, and we might be talking about either SIG continuing it now or Glock or Beretta beating them out. It's crazy. I mean, it's a weird kind of interwoven little system there in history. So those companies and a couple others submitted. I don't have all the notes in front of me, so I'm speaking a little off the cuff. And that kind of went through all the way until January of last year, January 2017, when the Army announced SIG as the winner of the competition. And so they won the modular handgun system competition. And just to clarify for folks, again, when we keep saying MHS and modular handgun system, people always zero in, heck, I do too, because it's the most important part, on the handgun itself. But as far as the way they describe it, when you sit and talk with the program managers and people who handle all this, you know, for the Army and for the different offices that have developed this, it is a quote-unquote system. So that system includes new types of rounds. I mean, for the first time ever, to my knowledge and to my reporting, hollow point bullets are now an option to be shot through this firearm in a tactical setting, service wide. Now, granted, those types of bullets have been available and likely have always been available. I don't know, you know, to those super secret cool units like MARSOC and SEALs and SF and stuff.
Right.
But for your standard soldier, standard Marine, that was not a legal option due to some treaty issues and interpretations. So the rounds are new. The holster is new. It is right now being produced by Safariland. But it's going to be, I think, bid out for larger, acquirements, procurements. I'm trying to think of it. They're going to add in, of course, the sighting systems and potentially the suppressor to match with it. So it's like, it's the gun is the core of it, but then all around that becomes the system. The gun itself is just the M17 and M18, the M17 being a standard size, the M18 being a compact size, and both of those chambered in 9mm.
Right. Have you had a chance to peel back, to peel the onion, relative to the drop test that has seemed, it seems a bit confounding because it first surfaces in commercial versions, and then the Army says, no, we fixed it, and then they tested it, and they said, oh, it's not fixed. Have you peeled the onion on that?
Yeah, that was a tricky one because we're so limited. Like, and again, this is where I would tip my hat to my competitors because I'm so new on the block, really, with this reporting on this topic. I didn't have a lot of kind of deep sources built into the system yet. And some of that was news is broken by my competitors. Again, you know, I all deference there. So what unfolded, which is really troubling, and I'll just kind of put it from the perspective of the reporter, because this is as I'm finding information out, right, and as it's being kind of made public. And this is not from how it actually happened; this is how it was revealed. So the Army makes their decision on the modern handgun system and picking SIG as the gun manufacturer in January of last year. And then there's, you know, little pieces of news kind of unfold out of that. It wasn't, I believe, I should have timelines and PowerPoints in front of me to do this right, but at some point I want to say it was in the summertime, so we're talking, you know, six plus months later, these civilian reports come out, and they're, you know, some of them are quote-unquote, you know, semi, you know, gun bloggers, people who've purchased the civilian version of this gun.
Right.
And then like put it through their own kind of torture test and found this wanting. There are a couple of police departments that have claimed issues, some isolated incidents that they've been kind of hit the brakes on using it with their department just until they get this all figured out with the drop test problems. There was one lawsuit filed in federal court. I think it was Connecticut. I know it was somewhere in New England, a police officer supposedly, allegedly, at least according to his lawsuit, was loading his vehicle with something and the gun comes out of a holster and hits the ground and shoots. I can't remember if it struck him. I think it struck him, or maybe a ricochet struck him. And so he was suing the gun manufacturer for the drop test. So there's a lot of – all that kind of surfaces in the summer with the civilian version. So immediately, myself and all my competitors who write about guns with the military have been following the MHS for, you know, longer than I have, are, you know, hitting SIG and hitting the Army and saying, what's going on with this? What's going on with this? And their response was fairly quick, saying that, you know, some of the trigger mechanism functions of the military version, the M17, M18, which is the adopted gun, are different than the civilian version. Because the civilian version, just so people know, you know, this is not a wholesale creation of SIG for the purposes of the MHS competition. They had created a gun, you know, for civilian and commercial sales that later became the MHS. I believe it released in 2014. So, you know, a good 3 years before the Army selects the MHS. Now, their claim, now the Army then claims at the time, this is like late summer after all these civilian problems kind of pop out in the media, that, yes, we were aware of this issue. It's not an issue with our version of the gun. We've done our own tests. This is all good. It's not a problem.
Right.
And then subsequent to that, they invited media, I want to say it was in October, maybe November, perhaps. It was November, actually, to come do a kind of roundtable discussion on the official fielding of the handgun. And all of your military folks are going to know what fielding means, but for any civilians, non-military, fielding just means like this is actually going into a unit, whether it's a radio or a gun or a boot or whatever, and it's been through testing, it's been certified, everybody signed off on it, it is now in a unit, and that is their new gun, that is their new boot, you know, the other stuff goes away. And that was happening with 101st Airborne late November, early December of last year. So just about, what, 4 or 5 months ago?
Yep.
And during that roundtable, you know, questions were asked, of course, you know, there was a SIG representative there. There were, of course, you know, Safariland representative, I think Remington Arms, I believe, or Winchester, I can't remember which, makes the ammo. I mean, there was reps of all. Everybody who had anything to do to touch the thing, even the people who made the holster, were there. And basically the what kind of came out of that was that actually, the Army had heard these problems, ordered their own rounds of more drop tests, and there wasn't a single drop test misfire during their own subsequent, like, second round of testing. This would have been, you know, I think early fall of last year, so it would have been a good 9-plus months since it was actually chosen by the Army, and after it had already undergone whatever, you know, last-minute tests that had to occur in the spring. There's been some documentation came out that showed that it was showing some, I think, some drop test issues earlier on in the testing, but that it was isolated and that there was other kind of factors that they pulled into that. Again, without, you know, pulling out that document and like spending a half an hour like digging through the details because my memory's not what it used to be, I guess. I can't remember the specific to just sitting here talking to you right now, but yeah.
It happens when you hit 40.
I know, right? I'm not getting your way. I'm going to be just done. Just hang it up.
My guest from Marine Corps Times, former Marine, current writer, Todd South. And so, Todd, talk to me about now. What is the Marine Corps' interest? So you've seen. So this thing has not been without controversy. You can see the historical origin is. But one of the interesting things that Mike talks about is just the cumbersome nature of the procurement system. And you're talking about technology that's years old now making its way into the United States military because of the procurement system. That it is old, it's legally cumbersome, but because all the money that's tied up into these bids and trying to make it fair, this is what we live with. When right now you could throw that whole thing in the garbage and you could walk out and you could say, okay, off the shelf, I want that, and that. But we don't buy like that, and you can't buy like that for legal reasons because there is a lot of money tied up in it. In fact, the Marine Corps is being taken to task by Congress for its buy of the M27 from HK. And in spite of the price point that they got and the speed at which they will get it at, they're being drugged through the streets in Congress saying that why didn't this go to an American company and why didn't we bid it that way? So kind of interesting dichotomy as we spin the wheel about. Talk to us about, Todd, the Marine Corps interest. The Marine Corps interest, from what I've read and maybe from you, is more in the M18, the shortened version of it.
Well, there's both. So the initial interest that kind of came public for the Marine Corps. Let me pause for a second. I got to back up. So for at least 2+ years now, I guess this really didn't rise to like the top of a story level in most of the reporting that I saw prior to my beginning reporting on it. Nor did I necessarily make it a top priority until more recently. The main kind of coverage and reporting has been what is the Army doing? What is the Army doing? What is the Army doing? Because they're the biggest. They're going to buy the most. It's, you know, they have the biggest branch. If they buy a gun, pretty much everyone usually follows suit in some form or fashion,
right.
Even the Marine.
Right.
So that has been the focus. But going back to quotes that I found in my predecessor's articles and in my competitor's articles prior to me ever even knowing what the heck the MHS was more than a year ago when I came on board, there was always quotes about all the branches buying different quantities of this pistol. But that was part of the process of the contracting, part of the process of, so the Navy's buying it, the Air Force is buying it, the Army's buying it in big, big stocks, and the Marine Corps is going to buy it. It wasn't clear how the Marine Corps was going to buy it, when they were going to buy it, and what versions they wanted and how they're going to use them, until it became a little more clear with the FY19 budget request that came out, actually in February. I didn't get to report on it until just a couple weeks ago, just due to some other factors and a big plate of stuff on my desk, I guess. That outlined specific requests for specific quantities, specific amounts of money from the Marine Corps for this pistol, and then the footnote language saying why they were doing this and what it was going to mean. And we're literally talking about a 400-plus page document and like two sentences in fine print beneath a table of a bunch of, like Excel table of a bunch of quantities and figures. And because, I'll say my colleague, Sean Snow, who's the lead Marine Corps Times writer, he's a former MARSOC guy and, you know, way more combat experience than I am, and it's been longer in the Marine Corps too. It was kind of scratching at that a little bit. What's the Marine Corps angle on this? What's going on here? And he was getting basically no comment from the folks in Marine Corps Systems Command who kind of implement a lot of these different things for fielding into the Marine Corps, whether it's a weapon or a radio or whatever it might be. So that document shows in plain language right there that the Marine Corps is purchasing initially 35,000 MHS. I don't remember if it delved into the 17 or the 18, and their specific reasoning for that in the budget document presented to Congress to get approval was that it was more reliable and better maintenance and I guess increased lethality in it. I think they're kind of referencing the Army's, you know, modular aspects to increase lethality. So any Marine of any size can configure this thing to make it shoot accurately and shoot better with it because of its basic functions as compared to the M9. And in that exact language, they also, what was the nice kind of little kicker that as a reporter kind of gets you juiced up a little bit, was they lined out all the stuff it's replacing. And they pretty much lined out every single handgun the Marine Corps has. You know, the M9, the 1911, even the Glock. I mean, the Marine Corps purchased quantities of Glocks last year for concealed carry, the smaller versions for embassy folks and people that work in CID or Criminal Investigation Division. And also, I believe the MARSOC guys still use Glocks of some form. I can't remember which model. Now that's going to continue. The MARSOC guys, I mean, they're special ops for a reason. They get kind of special choice. They can tailor their packages to whatever they need to tailor the packages for whatever deployment. So they're going to keep using the Glock as far as the reporting has said. But everything else in waves is going to be replaced with the MHS just like it is in the Army. So that's the kind of most recent stuff on it. As far as the compact thing, that came out more for a batch of the Glocks were purchased. And there was discussions by a couple, at least Gunner Wade, who I think is recently retired,
right,
the 2nd Marine Division, about purchasing compact MHSs to kind of basically to experiment with and test with and see kind of if they would do better than the compact Glock for the purposes of just like small, like, you know, concealed carry overseas, kind of plainclothes work, you know, CID folks maybe, and perhaps, you know, like embassy folks who might be plainclothes and need a concealed carry if they're doing a kind of security detail or out in town kind of thing. So that was the initial kind of like tip of the iceberg coming up above water, for folks learning about what the Marine Corps going to do with this. And that was sometime last year that kind of became a public issue. But now we have the actual documents, the actual budget request, exactly what they say they're doing and the quantities they're doing it for the price they're doing it. And that's all printed in public, you know, public domain. So.
All right. The, you know, because it's interesting. A pistol is relatively useless in combat, except if maybe if you're in close quarters battle and, you know, your weapon jams or something like that. If you're doing, you know, what Todd did, you know, a pistol is of relatively no value to you, right? And the times that I was out and about in Iraq, both Iraq and Afghanistan, a pistol is of zero value to you, except trying to fend off being overrun. In fact, I was reading about the SS in 1975. The United States had a ship that was captured off Cambodia, the Mayaguez. and taken to an island called Koh Tang Island. And Golf Company and Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, were on Okinawa out in the central training area. Within 24 hours, they were yanked out of the CTA. They were put on trucks, taken to Kadena, flown to Thailand, and inside another 24 hours, they were inserted into Koh Tang Island. There was three elements. There were only supposed to be two, but the insert of the Alpha Command Group into one of the LZs, they couldn't get in there because of the heavy volume of fire. They went down the coast, found a place to put the CH-53 down. Air Force pilots were, and these guys were ballsy guys too. It was amazing. These Air Force 53 pilots put them down. They get off the bird, the Alpha Command Group. They have, with 28 Marines, they have three rifles. And everybody else has a pistol. And, you know, they talk about the helpless feeling that they have. Now we're ashore. We don't have anybody else near us. And all we have is pistols. And we're about to get smoked. But if three or four dudes show up with rifles, you know, we're not, there's not a whole lot, despite the quote-unquote stopping power of the 45, there's not a whole lot of good these things are going to do. So it's interesting just even about the whole, you know, who uses pistols and for, you know, for MARSOC guys, you know, they trick their own kid out. Do you like him? Do you need a backup weapon? Blah, 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 blah. But I think for regular infantry units and other, I think their primary function is, for officers who don't want to lug a rifle around with them inside of CPs, they use pistols. Other than that, you don't see too many guys in combat, you know, pulling out a pistol and doing any damage with it. So I think the whole conversation, somewhat interesting. They're used for, what, duty in the Marine Corps, right? Got to have a weapon so you have a pistol. But I found it interesting, especially given some of the controversies over the SIG stuff. I've got an email. Any thoughts on any of that, Todd? I mean, it's just kind of me rambling a little bit.
Oh yeah, no, I think it's, you know, I would kind of cut it both ways. I actually wrote a story for the Army Times later last year. I mean, it may have run actually earlier this year. Kind of looking at like the increasing, improving the pistol and all the attention that was put to it as kind of a signpost for trying to improve things overall for the squad level, which has since become the Close Combat Lethality Task Force, which is, you know, so that's one argument to make. And that was more of a kind of like, let's look at all this kind of in a global fashion, all these pieces together create this supposedly better soldier, better Marine. And that's kind of the argument that's being pushed forward, and we'll see kind of how that plays out. There's a lot of experimentation done. On the other side, you're totally right. Like this, you know, there's nobody in their right mind, you know, is going to rely on a pistol unless their weapon is jammed, been lost, destroyed, and they're being overrun, or like, yeah, if they're in a tunnel or a CQB situation where they can't maneuver a rifle around, they just need firepower within the next, you know, 20 feet of them or 10 feet of them. You know, that being said, it's always good to have a backup. I think that the attention, and this is no reporting in what I'm about to say. This is just me shooting off the cuff, gut kind of feeling, having grown up in a gun culture and still loving shooting and firearms. I just think you can't underestimate a couple factors when it comes to firearms and like the popular imagination. I think that, you know, even if they're not familiar with firearms, you know, Congress people can grasp it. You know, they understand pistol goes bang. I saw Westerns. I saw cop shows. This is something I can grasp. It's not a stealth bomber. It's not a certain kind of guided missile. Like, and there's also this extremely emotional attachment. Like, I write about all kinds of topics from tanks to pistols to, you know, people getting court-martialed to whatever. And if I write one tiny little update to a larger story about the handgun or about the M27 or about a new suppressor, I mean, that story always gets a lot more traffic and a lot more comments and a lot more views on anything else, even if it's stuff that would really truly affect the readers and their friends and families much, much more deeply. I think there's an emotional attachment to the firearm, especially for military people, because I think I was arguing, or not arguing, but I was kind of having this conversation with somebody in the office the other day, was, you know, you got to think about, like, you look across the services. You're in the Navy, you're going to be on a ship, you're going to know the ship, you're part of the job, you know how that works, you know. if you're in the Marines, you might be a comm guy like me where you spend all your time looking at certain cars and twisting radio knobs and getting comms and putting up antennas. You know, there's all different kinds of things you're going to do that do not necessarily identify with the rest of the force, that you can't really kind of comprehend the job of another guy or gal, but you all carry the same rifle. You all shoot the same pistol when you get to that rank. Like, you all have your hands on something that is kind of intimate and across the board and easily identifiable. And I that's why I think to this day you'll see Korea and Vietnam era vets arguing it out about the 45 or the whatever, you know, or how the M16 failed them in combat, or like why we should have gone back to the M14, which is a 50-year-old discussion by now that never ends. I mean, like, I think that there's a lot wrapped up into it goes a lot deeper than just the practical aspects. Although the practical aspects are what should be important, I totally agree.
Interesting. All right, what's next? So is the Marine Corps and the other services, are those buys? Those buys are, they're set in stone, yes, at this point?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in terms of like the approvals through Congress and the signing off, yeah, it appears to be. I mean, I haven't covered the follow up to that, in terms of where the bills and all the signing off was and actual orders. And I don't remember if the documents gave the kind of delivery dates. I would suspect if they were making orders, it would go by quarter. They usually don't do it, I don't think, in all in one huge allotment. They usually do it like by quarters throughout the fiscal year, and then they kind of arrive as they're produced and manufactured by the companies. So, I mean, I would assume by the end of the calendar year or before you would see Marine units receiving the new pistol. But again, I'd have to go back and look at the details.
Okay. The most interesting part of this purchase has been what?
For me?
Yeah.
Just as reporting it?
Yeah.
I don't know. As far as the Marine Corps aspect or just the overall program?
Like overall. Yeah, overall. Because I will tell you, because I think a lot of people fully expected that Glock would win this. Given the affinity of special operators for Glock, given the affinity that a lot of shooters have for Glock, I think that a lot of eyes got rolled when Sig Sauer walked away with the contract. So many people, you know, do shoot, and there is this link that people have to these two weapons. I'm just curious, what you found, to be kind of interesting about the whole story.
Well, I think, that helps frame it for me a little bit better. I thank you though. But, just having grown up in a little bit of the gun culture and kind of try to keep tabs on it, absolutely surprising that Glock didn't get it given its popularity and its kind of robust, like widespread use. But here's the wrinkle to that I don't think a lot of people, want to give credit to, is that if you look closely at the submission requirements and kind of how things were handled in terms of providing things, Glock basically, they didn't bring anything new to the table. Like, they basically brought the gun that they've had in kind of a slightly modified sense, one submission that they said could be used for both compact and standard size. And they kind of, you know, I'm sure some Glock folks out there are going to hate me for saying this, they kind of just said, F you, we're Glock, we're the best, take it or leave it. And they said, we'll leave it. And Sig presented exactly what the specifications were. We're getting very bureaucratic here and wonky. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that that's the way it presented itself. They followed the kind of the spirit and the letter of what the submissions were. They worked it. I don't know how they worked it. I don't know all the details in the back room stuff or the behind the curtain stuff for any of the companies. That's not my job. But that's kind of where that kind of fell out. And I think that the Army said, we're looking to do this, we want to do this quickly, and by Army standards, they actually did do it pretty quickly.
Right.
And Sig complied and met all the stuff they wanted to meet, and somebody who makes decisions liked that better than the others once everything was said and done. I think Glock could have got it had they not necessarily just said, hey, we're the best, we've always been the best, why are you even looking at anybody else? And that's kind of seemed to be the way things were presented to me, at least after talking to folks, after seeing the submissions and everything. And so there's an art to it. It's not just a pure science. There's people dealing with people in bureaucracies. I'm not defending it. I don't support it. But it's a reality. And if people don't want to believe that reality, then they're never going to understand how these things work.
Well, and I'll tell you what, it's a specific reality in the procurement business. Because that is the game, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right, it's the game. The one email, and I'll let you go. And again, my guest, Marine Corps Times writer Todd South, former Marine, and we're talking about he's written about the pistol buy that the Army's done. We've been talking over the course of the last hour about that, as well as his career. Mac, the gunner made the comment that Glock did not even, given the scope of this buy, modify their safety, which gives people a lot of problem. Does Todd have any comment about that? Yeah, you know.
He's absolutely right. This is, in fact, if I recall, and I may be cribbing notes off of a competitor having reported this, that was a big factor in some of the submission guidelines. Like that was, because I mean, you got to remember too, folks. I mean, like that's what people quickly forget their own knowledge base. And you know, if the readership, or I'm sorry, the listeners, apologize, listeners to your program have, you know, more than just even a couple of years of experience with firearms, you know, military or non-military, they're vastly more experienced with firearms than most of the people coming into the military. So you have to make these systems as simple to operate and as safe to operate for the lowest common denominator. We may not like it, but that is the way it is.
Right.
And as far as the safety, I remember that being an issue. And it goes back to, I think Glock really missed a huge opportunity because they took themselves, like, they kind of got on a high horse.
That said, we will teach you to come to our version of the firearm, and the fact that you have to entertain the lowest common denominator doesn't mean that we'll redesign for it. It sounds like, you know, kind of
you said it better than I did. Yeah.
Well, because I asked Mike that question. Why, given the size of the contract, wouldn't Glock, you know, engineer a safety and say, okay, we can dumb it down a little bit for you. Here you go. And the fact that they didn't do that to me is like, wow, pretty amazing, pretty amazing. All right, Todd,
I've shot both, and it's just personal. I'm by no stretch I was a sharpshooter, pistol shooter. Just to be frank, I didn't even make expert, and I love shooting pistols. I don't do as well as I could, or shoot as I could, or as much as I could. Just the feel of it, and just the firing of it, I personally prefer a lot. But that has nothing to do with Big Army deciding what they're going to buy and everyone else following suit, because Big Army has the bucks and they're going to buy the gun that they want and people are going to probably follow suit. So that's just the way it works, man.
Got it. What about, what's the next thing you're working on?
Oh, everything's on my plate, man. I don't know. I'm trying to think. I don't think anything firearms related. I mean, I'm doing ongoing coverage of the next generation squad weapon, which is a big, huge umbrella project that the Army's doing to develop their new, a new assault rifle for the next 3 to 4 years. There'll be different iterations popping out. There's prototypes going, whole kinds of advancements. Just to hit the brakes on it real quick, you know, it's kind of been there, done that. They've said this before and tried it before. We'll see if the proof is in the pudding. Supposedly the technology is there. We'll see if the bureaucracy, procurement, and others, you know, make the right choices. Yeah, that's kind of part of my job. Hopefully I try to keep them honest, and that's the best I can do. So.
Got it. All right, man, tell everybody where they find your work.
We're militarytimes.com is the main page for all of our publications, kind of flow to that one. I'm on Twitter at TSouthJourno. So T is in Tango, South is in North South, and Journo is in Journalist. If you want to follow stuff I post on Twitter.
All right. First of all, if you don't mind, every once in a while we'll call you up and ask you to come on and talk about your work. But enjoy the visit, Todd. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thank you. I hope I provided something. I appreciate your thoughts. And again, if people can attack it all they want, hopefully I'll learn more. So let me know if I got something wrong or if something else I should be checking out.
No, come on, man. You know we love comm Marines. We love those guys. we don't talk unless you guys do what you do. All right, man. Thanks for the visit.
All right, take care.
There you have it. That is Tom South, former Marine, and now he's a journalist. Awesome stuff. You know, we'll get Mike on here momentarily, and we'll see what he has to say. But, Glock, to me, really, really interesting in terms of them not wanting to play the game. Like, this is our product, and we're not changing. So, anyway. All right, more of All Marine Radio coming up next. We'll take a quick break. We'll get the gunner on. Don't touch that dial. We continue on a Monday. Hour 3 coming up.